And it's KVC Arts Now on KVCR, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. On this edition of the program, revisiting a conversation with Mark Volman, who passed away September 5th, 2025. I spoke with Volman as he was coming to the region for one of the Happy Together tours, which gave me the opportunity to hear about his time with Frank Zappa. But before Zappa, he was one of the founding members of the Turtles. I was absolutely stunned to find out that after the breakup of the Turtles, not only could he not use the name the Turtles, but he couldn't even use his own name. So I kind of had to know if this was true, or was my understanding of it somewhat misconstrued?
No, that's a clause pretty much in every contract for a young artist signing with a record company or even a personal manager. Personal managers ask for artists to sign contracts that bind them individually and collectively, and they do that so that if a band gets a record deal with a manager and then decide they don't want the manager, you can't just drop the manager because you don't like them. And that's what happened with us. We were bound to a record company individually and collectively, so when we began a lawsuit against them, they basically said, that's fine, but if you make any records as an individual, you're still with us. You can't just break up and then leave us because you want to. And that's what happened to the Turtles. We filed a lawsuit to get out of that. And that's how we became known as Flo and Eddie. The Turtles went into this lawsuit, and we made an album with Frank Zappa, Chunga's Revenge, yeah. And we couldn't use our real names or the names of the Turtles on the record because of the lawsuit. So we had to have that lawsuit clear up ownership of the name, the Turtles, and eventually that would let us free from the contract to be able to use our real names on the second album we did with Frank live at the Fillmore East, yeah. Which we were listed as Mark Volman and Howard Kalin again. So that's a crazy clause, and that clause is still a part of the music industry today and a part of personal management. It's the way a personal manager protects himself if a band breaks up just to get out of the contract. So it works both ways as a protection. Most young people who sign record contracts do not even know what's in the contract. Right. I would say 99% of the time, they don't understand that when they make records, the records are owned by the record company and that recordings are owned by the record company. The record companies, with a lot of young artists, their job is not to teach them the music business. So Young artists, unfortunately, get caught in these situations where they sign contracts because it seems so darn exciting, but they don't even know that they've bound themselves to a record company, quite possibly for decades.
Mm. So with the Mothers, you mentioned Chunga's Revenge, if I remember correctly. That's a combination of both works with Censorship and Industrial Vacuum Cleaners. I'm going to have to go back to the liner notes on that one. But with the Live at the Fillmore East, June of 71, this was pretty much a concept album about, let's say, stereotypical rockers and groupies of a certain caliber. And I use the word caliber quite on purpose here regarding the Bullet. So yeah. These types of shows where you were acting out characters of Vanilla Fudge, telling a story and all that, and with the Mud Shark, how much of these shows were tightly rehearsed? There seems like there's, you know, of course, more than music here. It seems like there's a ton of improv with bits like this.
Yeah, I think we had a guideline. You know, we had probably about 30 or 40% structured, maybe even a little bit more conceptually with what songs were going to work within the concept of what we were doing there. You have to understand, and for a Zappa fanatic or for a Zappa fan might be able to understand what I'm about to say, that the material from the White Album Live at the Fillmore East was meant to fit into the motion picture 200 Motels. So the entire segment of the pop star and the groupie that takes place in the White Fillmore East album, yeah, never got into the movie. because the movie was never completed properly. The movie shot for only about a week's time, and we never got to finish the segment that appears in the White Album. So if a Zappa fan knows the material from 200 Motels, and if they take the material from the White Fillmore East Album and plug it in to a certain section of the 200 Motels, it would considerably answer the questions of what was missing from the 200 Motels finished product, which unfortunately just never was really explained, but that was the intention. So the White Album was an introductory album with a lot of material that was opening the door to the pop star shenanigans of what ultimately the motion picture 200 Motels was about: life on the road, the crazy life of rock and roll stars, touring, groupies, and everything else. So the White Album is a little bit of a touch of that, with the stuff with the Happy Together being the ending result of what the pop star must perform so that the groupie will do her performance.
Delicately put there, Mark. Thank you. Yeah.
But the whole era that we spent with Frank, which really seemed like so much time, because, I mean, there's so much material with me and Howard during that time, that Just Another Band from L.A., 200 Motels, Chunga's Revenge, Live at the Fillmore East. And then we're on 12 albums of You Can't Do That on Stage Anymore, the bootleg albums that became professionally released by Rhino, which includes so much of the Flo and Eddie era. It almost feels like we were there forever.
Yeah, right.
But all that material happened in just a short two-year span, and that's a direct door opener to the person that was Frank Zappa. I mean, he was just a tremendous workaholic, and he recorded almost every moment that we ever were ever together, even to the point that he would travel with a microphone and a tape recorder when we weren't on stage. I think Frank was really excited to have Howard and I as a part of the group, because we brought spontaneity to it that the band really lacked, which was that improvisational ability to be told to do something and turn it into something crazy.
Yes,
and
yes.
Frank loved that about Howard and I and the group. You know, I think we love the fact that he gave us an open door. Frank always looked at us as being the leaders on stage, and we always appreciated that, you know.
I guess he was more of a narrator then. That's an interesting way. I'm going to have to listen with a new ear now then.
Well, he was such a voyeur to almost every incident that we were a part of, and he found himself getting into the material as more of a narrator, yes. And that was the way it was all written, was, and that's why we performed basically for him. I mean, if we could make Frank laugh, then the audience was going to be in an uproar. I mean, because Frank was really, he wasn't very easy at being someone you could just turn around and take a deadpan strategist and turn him into an observing person to just stand there and laugh at the things we would do on stage. And the more we attempted to make Frank laugh, the more he loved it. And the more things just got completely out of hand on a night-to-night basis. And I think that was one of the fun things about that period during the time we were there with all these really excellent people, you know, Ainsley Dunbar, Ian Underwood, Donnie Preston, George Duke. Jim Pons. These were all really excellent musicians that allowed Frank to play a real wide variety of music. And maybe it was a little more comedy on stage than the diehard Zappa fans, you know, might want to see. But that was what Frank was really enjoying writing at that time.
He was moving from the, say, the Cruising with the Reuben and the Jet stuff into this, and before he went on to, well, more of the censorship-driven stuff later on. Within this show, there's a tune called The Mud Shark, and it was inspired by an incident with John Bonham, and people can look that one up because I'd have to be extra delicate in describing this one on the air. I'm just only curious if Zap or any of you guys got any feedback from Bonham. Because we're talking about an incident with a shark.
Well, not that I know of, but quite honestly, I mean, there's never been a verification that any of that was true.
Okay,
I mean,
true.
From our standpoint, we did catch mud sharks from our hotel rooms. That was one of the very big things about the Edgewater Hotel, which is still there, was that you could fish from your room and catch these small little mud sharks, and that was why the story, which turned into a rock star groupie story, I think it had been, you know, a performance art project with Led Zeppelin, but when we took the story and turned it into our part of our musical, which was the 200 Motel, just another band from L.A., that was more of a fantasy-driven Frank Zappa taking the remnants of a couple of rumors and then turning it into a reality. You know, in fantasy, anything you call reality can be the truth because you don't have to answer for it if it's fantasy. You only have to answer for it if you try to say this is the truth. And I think the story's so funny in its fantasy implications that it's better as a comedy in fantasy than it is, did it really happen? Who cares?
Yeah.
Because it became such a fun story, and every night that story grew, and the implications of that story, even fans of NPR, would know that we're talking in abstracts here, but in reality, the rock star consideration of putting rock stars in a hotel with groupies and fish is going to have an incredible amount of thinking about. But not only when Frank got a hold of it, it turned into something completely out of this world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think really when Frank, he took truth and then made it a Frank Zappa truth. And Frank Zappa truths were a lot funnier than maybe what the actual story was when it was really true. I don't know how to be any more, you know, protective of making sure we don't get too far. But, you know, you can go online and look up the Mud Shark story and you can get it. But it's always fun. Like, we were just in Seattle maybe 4 days ago playing a show. And, you know, we went by the Edgewater Hotel and it brought back a lot of good memories.
Oh, boy.
It was really fun to see. And we sat there kind of like, wow, we used to stay there. Now, you know, you don't play in downtown Seattle. You go there and we end up playing in some of the big, they got a lot of really big casinos up there now. And so the rock and roll business has become more of a casino-driven industry than just, you know, the old rock shows we play at, you know.
Yeah. Somewhere between clubs and arenas. That's
where
we've got.
That's a product of us just getting older. You know, I'm sure with all the guys who played jazz back in the big bands of the 40s and when the 50s and 60s came along and the ballrooms died out and the rock and roll venues started growing, and it's really changeable, you know. And I'm glad we got to experience sort of both eras.
I'm David Fleming. On this edition of the program, I'm revisiting my conversation with one of the founding members of the Turtles, Mark Volman, who passed away in early September 2025. Later, Volman's path to becoming a professor in Nashville after the time between starting and finishing his bachelor's degree spanned a little over 30 years. First, more on his time with Frank Zappa and how that time came to an end.
You were touring around doing the whole, well, bits with the Mud Shark and the groupies and the Bullet and everything. Did you alter anything for the... Yeah, isn't it? I'm really dancing around this stuff. People are going to go listen to this album and they'll be shocked at what I'm actually talking about.
Well, I mean, the crazy one was the stuff that we were just... I mean, the sad history with Frank is that it ended before it was done. I mean, the unfortunate thing was is that, you know, Frank and us ended before Frank wanted it to end. I mean, that was because, you know, the fire in Montreux, which became the foundation for Deep Purple,
Smoke on the Water,
was the beginning of the end of our career with Frank. That fire happened. We went to London. We played one of six sellout shows, and at the end of the very first show, at the Rainbow Theater, a kid ran on stage, pushed Frank into a 9-foot orchestra pit, and our career with the Mothers of Invention ended with a fractured skull and a pierced lung and a fractured leg, and that was it. Frank went into the hospitals, and for the next year, Frank recovered, and Howard and I started making records as Flo and Eddie, and the Turtles came back. And we never worked with Frank again.
Oh, my gosh.
And the kind of phenomena we created in just 2 years, what was ahead was a full animated project called Billy the Mountain, which was really the next thing Frank wanted to do. Think back now, 1972, Frank was going to do a full-length animated feature film called Billy the Mountain. And think now to all these companies that do these animated full-length features. Frank was already thinking about this in 72 with this crazy story of the mountain that goes to be on the Tonight Show. And I mean, it's insane that we never really got to move off and do it. Also, Devon was in the works. Devon was the story that Frank had written about the pornography business, and it was a really interesting story, Devon, which we were doing in German. And so we were studying German at this point, continually traveling around the world, performing about 20 minutes of Devon in German, singing German from the stage. So this was like the next two things Frank was already working on. And when we lost him to his injuries, we never got to complete or even finalize some of the things that we were working on. So that's one of those things that you can look back in hindsight and say, maybe it's a good thing we didn't get to finish it or whatever, but there was some exciting stuff that we were working on that we'll, you know, never know how it would have ended up.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I would have liked to have seen. I mean, we got Baby Snakes. He did some animated stuff later on. I would have loved to have seen this.
Yes. Well, I mean, Frank continued to be a genius. I mean, our part of it was just such a short. What we gave Frank was an opportunity to dabble in things that he would have never have done without Flo and Eddie. Now, you can sit there and go, well, it was not my favorite part or it was my favorite part. And there's lots of, you know, opinions on whether the Flo and Eddie era was the best time or the worst time. So, you know, for true Zappa fans, I think you go, well, it was for 2 years. It was a very unique part of the Frank Zappa history. And it was fun for us to be with Frank. And I think Frank, if he was alive, would say that it was probably fun for him, too. And I think that that was really the best thing that came out of it for those 2 years. It was just really a fun time. We were not bound to this earth, you know. We were doing things that were really fun and offbeat and maybe a little off color and maybe even a bit bit negative and maybe a little bit hard to understand, but it made Frank laugh. And Frank was one of those kinds of people that you just wanted to be able to help him generate this kind of crazy world of Frank Zappa that we were able to help him reach new, you know, dimensions with. And, you know, for the diehard fans, I think they get it. For the ones who just thought it was not very good, you know, that's an opinion that I can understand. I was a Frank Zappa fan and loved the music of Frank Zappa before I was in it. I'm not sure the era I was in it was as good as some of the things I loved about Frank Zappa, but I still had a really good time doing it.
It seems to be what it's supposed to be about anyway, and that is just, you were touching on that a lot, and a lot of fun. Okay, so Mark, one more thing here before we, this has just been really great, but I have to ask, both you and I received our bachelor's degrees in 1997. I started in 1984. You started in 1965. So I thought 13 years was crazy. You got 32 years. Yeah, hey, whatever, that's cool. We all come and go a bit, in our case a lot, but
well,
made you even go back.
I want to kind of clear that up. I never really started. I mean, I told my parents I was going to college. I was at Santa Monica City College, but I only went to one class. And I went to one class and realized that college was not going to be something I was going to be any good at. I mean, I was able to pull the wool over the eyes of my high school teachers and get out of there with, you know, I was a class clown with a 1.9 GPA. You know, I mean, I was not really going anywhere. And there's a lot of people who might look at what I do now and say, yeah, that's exactly what you're doing now, nothing. But the truth be told is I really never even started college until 1994 or 93. Okay.
Right.
So I started at Valley State College taking full-time college courses. It was not online. It was not easy. I was a, you know, 45-year-old. You know, still touring as the Turtles. So when I started college at Valley College and actually did good, an advisor there said, well, maybe you ought to start thinking about four-year college. Only at that point did I think, well, that would be interesting to survey, and they helped me fill out some of the paperwork, and I got accepted at a couple of the California universities, but I chose to have a meeting with somebody over at Loyola Marymount because I was interested in exploring a minor in theology because my mother was a Catholic, and so I had been kind of teased a little bit with Catholicism, but my father was Jewish, so I was kind of in this kind of gray matter of religion. And so
I did my limbo.
Theology and kind of explored a little bit more theologically philosophy of religion and Christianity and so forth. And I graduated with a communications degree at Loyola in 1997. And at that point, they asked me to teach courses in music business. Would I be interested in their entertainment program? And I did a little research and found a professor named Larry Wackholtz, who was dabbling in music business courses, and he helped me put together a course at Loyola. But at the same time, the dean of music at L.A. Valley College asked me if I would put a course together for L.A. Valley College on the business of music. So I was actually in 97, 98, 99, I was teaching four courses. I had a full schedule, full class load, teaching at two different universities while I was doing my studies for my master's.
Wow.
So I did my master's in fine arts at Loyola. I did it in film, a theory, and screenwriting because I thought maybe I could teach film. That was becoming a really big topic. Film school was opening up at Loyola. But then I discovered after graduating that it was never going to turn into full-time there. And so my wife and I chose at that time, we were looking for new places to live, and Nashville came into mind through my wife because she had family living in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Greenville, South Carolina, and so forth. So we found a home outside of Nashville, and while I was there, I found out Larry Wackholtz was teaching there. I called him, and he asked me if I would do some substitute teaching because he was in a divorce, and I said, yeah, I took on a class at Belmont University who offered me a job the next semester, and then I've been there for the now 9 years.
Okay, so very much a casual thing.
Yeah, I mean, I never got to really start college in 65, so I didn't put in any college. I did one day, and then the next day I didn't show up, and then the next week I didn't show up, and so I was lying to my parents that I was going to college, but I was not. I was waiting for to see if the record we had made was going to do anything, and it was an Ain't Me Babe, and I say that because I graduated high school in February of 65. It Ain't Me Babe came out around April, and we were out on a Dick Clark tour by June.
Oh,
so
wow.
Within that, it wasn't much time for me to wait. Our song actually started getting played on the national scene, and so I don't think I would have been able to have gone to college anyway, which was just fine. But when I finally told my parents that I hadn't been going to school, they were just, you know, my mom was like, oh, that just is like, it was just perfect, you know. So then when the record hit, it was like, well, we tried college. Now, if the record doesn't happen, I'm going to be back working with my dad in the sheet metal business.
Oh,
that's
gosh.
What I had to promise.
Yeah, for me, yeah, it was the Navy.
I was so lucky because I would have been the worst sheet metal worker ever.
It would have been
probably just like cut my hands off or something.
That would get you out of it.
So
okay.
You think about it, you know, just the blessings of life and how things worked out is just incredible that these two guys who are still friends from high school are still doing what we left high school to do, you know?
You and Howard.
And it's scary that I get to see Howard and be with him every single day of my life. We've been together now almost 53 years.
Oh, my gosh.
And
tattoos don't last that long.
Yeah, I mean, that just doesn't happen in this lifetime to people, you know?
Wow.
Put it all in a big basket and climb back on the tour bus. It goes away.
I would imagine.
It's like the Barnum and Bailey Circus, you know?
Except we don't want to see that tent come down.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time. This has been
fantastic. I enjoyed it.
Me too, Mark.
I don't usually do enjoy these things, but I've enjoyed your knowledge is good of our history. And so we got to talk about some stuff that I don't always get to. So I appreciate it.
On this edition of KVC Arts, I've been revisiting my conversation with Mark Volman, who passed away September 5th, 2025, at the age of 78. I was fortunate to have this conversation, and there's more of it on a KVC Arts from several years ago. Go to our website, and a search will take you there. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Mark Volman. Rest in peace. And here at KVCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Sandy Hodela, Zach Mays, Adam Rainey Ruiz, Joel Morales, Jessica Greenwell, Champ Chipman, and Shireen Awad. Many past KVC Arts can be found through iTunes, NPR One, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, and most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.